Big day. Let's see if we can do it. Get to the end of the, you know, we've been on this long march, starting from the basic logical input, and then unrolling through general Yang-Mills theory to the specific Yang-Mills theory of the standard model, and then finally showing that if the potential for the Higgs boson is unstable about the symmetric point, the Higgs falls to one of the asymmetric vacua, and when we plug that in and split the Lagrangian into its quadratic and non-quadratic parts, that its free part and its interaction part, then we get the Feynman diagrams that appear to describe the universe as we know it so far. So anyway, it would be great to get to the end of that. Let's see if we can do it. I mean, I'm a little worried that I'm not going to make it, in which case that's not the end of the world. But because I'm prone to rambling like this about not particularly relevant things, so that could happen again, and it's already happened for 5 minutes. So okay, so good. So we had a couple slides left in the previous lecture, so I just wanted to wrap those up. So this was about finding the quadratic part of the Lagrangian after we plug in the Higgs boson. So where were we? You know, we were looking at the first two bosonic lines in the action, and we had shown that when you plug in the Higgs VEV, when you split the Higgs field into its VEV plus the Higgs boson, and then collect the quadratic terms in this Lagrangian and throw out all the non-quadratic terms, you get this Lagrangian. So we had 8 plus 3 plus 1 copies of the Lagrangian for electromagnetism, and then we had kinetic term for the Higgs boson. We had something that looked like a mass term for the Higgs boson. And then we had a bunch of terms that came from squaring this thing and that looked like mass terms for the various vector fields W1, W2, W3, and B. But, okay, when I say mass terms, you know, in field theory, mass terms are terms that are quadratic in the fields and don't involve any derivatives. So for example, this looks like a mass term for the W1 boson because it's W1 squared, quadratic in the W1 boson, no derivatives. And it has some coefficient which would normally be interpreted as the mass. And so this looks like a mass term for the W1 boson. This looks like a mass term for the W2 boson. This thing looks like some mass term for something, but it's some combination of the W3 and B bosons. And so basically the next step here is that we want to rewrite this line in a more conventional form where it's a bunch of completely decoupled diagonalized quadratic Lagrangians that can each be, so we want to rewrite it as a sort of sum of a bunch of independent quadratic Lagrangians, each of which has a conventional interpretation as, you know, the Lagrangian for a massive boson plus the Lagrangian for another completely decoupled massive vector field, etc. So we want to write it like this, where we have the ordinary kinetic terms for our 8 plus 3 plus, well, okay, sorry, we want to write it like this, where these will be the kinetic terms, and then for the vector bosons, here's our kinetic term for the Higgs boson, and then we have the sort of conventional mass term for a conventional Klein-Gordon field. Its mass term would look like this, with a minus 1/2 times its mass times the field squared. That's the thing where this is the thing where if we calculated the equation of motion, we would find that the momentum would have to satisfy the 4 momentum squared would be equal to minus mu h here. So if we compare, if we compare this mass term to this mass term, we first get to read off that the physical mass mu h squared of the physical mass mu h is related to the parameter m that appeared in the original standard model Lagrangian, this guy, by this formula, okay? And similarly, we want to compare this line to this line to relate the parameters appearing directly in the Lagrangian to the actual physical parameters that appear in nature. Okay, so let's next look at the so much for the scalar field. We have one scalar field and it has this mass that we just read off. What about the vector fields here? Well, so first of all, here's the kinetic term for 8 gluons. And you see there's no corresponding Gs on the next line, no mass terms for those. So we get, you know, these are we find that the 8 gluons have remained massless, just as we expected. Similarly, here is the kinetic term for, let me get there in a different order. So what I wanted to say, what I want to say instead is that if we look at the kinetic term for the W1 and W2 bosons now, okay, so here, you know, in this term, this includes a W mu nu 1 squared term, the kinetic term for the W1 boson, with this conventional factor of minus a quarter in front. And then here we have the corresponding term W1 squared. And if this was a conventionally normalized mass term, it would have a minus 1/2 times the mass of it, that particle squared out here. So by comparing this with this more conventionally normalized minus 1/2 coefficient, we get to read off that the W boson has a mass which is which is 1/4 times the SU2 gauge coupling squared times the Higgs-Vev squared. Now, why did I write W plus and W minus here instead of W1 and W2 up here? Well, I'm just using the fact that previously we had described that I could think of W1 and W2 as two independent real vector fields. But, you know, if you look at how the gauge transformation acts on them, you'll see that actually they're still getting mixed together by the residual unbroken U1 gauge symmetry. So actually, instead of, they get transformed into one another by the U1 gauge symmetry of electromagnetism. So really it's more correct to, or better, to group them into their irreducible representation and treat them that as a particle. That's what we do here. We define W plus and W minus as W1 plus or minus I times W2. So then you'll see that this term just gets rewritten like this. And the kinetic term, the W1 and W2 kinetic terms here, just get rewritten like this when we redefine the fields that way. Okay, so much for the W1 and W2 gauge bosons. We've grouped them into the W plus and W minus gauge bosons and found their mass. What about the remaining two gauge bosons here, which were the W3 coming from this term and the B coming from this term? What's the story with their particle content and masses? Well, you see that the problem here again is that we want to diagonalize the second line here. So when we're working in the original W3 and B basis, the quadratic term is not diagonalized here. It's been, yeah, the there's also cross terms between W mu and B mu, W3 and B. So what we want to do is we want to sort of make a change of basis, a field rotation in field space. So switch from this basis, the B and W3 basis, to a new basis, which we'll call the A and Z basis. So A and Z will just be two different linear combinations of the fields B and W3, such that, well, what do we want? What are the requirements? Well, we want the first line the first line here is diagonal. The first line here is already diagonal. We want to, if I take a smaller highlighter, that'll maybe make me have to erase less. Two things I should have figured out a long time ago, but anyway. Okay, so what about a really small highlighter? It's gonna be a whole new, we're gonna have to try it. Something else. We'll never know until we try it. Okay, so the first line here was diagonal, and in particular we had these two diagonal kinetic terms, W3 squared term here and a B squared term here. And so when we want our change of basis to not mess that up, we want the kinetic terms to still be diagonal in the new basis. And so if you check, you'll see that that means that the rotation, the 2x2 linear transformation has to be an orthogonal matrix. It has to be a rotation matrix. So it has to be cosine and minus sine and cosine of some angle, which is now traditionally called theta W, called the Weinberg angle, even though I think maybe it was actually Glashow who originally realized a lot of this. I think Glashow was the one who originally realized that the U1 of electromagnetism came from SU2 times U1 of hypercharge. Figured out a bunch of this stuff, and then maybe is angry that it didn't get enough credit for it, which is probably has some truth to it. Anyway, so nevertheless, this is called the Weinberg angle you hear. And it, by the way, famously there was a Nobel Prize given for this to the three people, Glashow, Weinberg, and Salam, who were primarily responsible for figuring out the electroweak part of the standard model. And Weinberg's paper sort of came last and was the one that maybe got everything the rightest, got everything in its final form. But then the earlier papers, you know, contributed key ideas. I mean, yeah, and as I say, Glashow maybe had some of the fundamental ideas first. So we want to make a rotation here, a rotation matrix here. So if you now plug in this linear transformation, you replace the W's on this line with the Z's using this transformation matrix, you can ask, okay, what rotation angle would be needed to make the, so that at the end of the day, I just get the sum of a mass term, some mass term times z squared plus another mass term times a squared, which will turn out to be 0 times a squared, and no cross term, no az cross term. And then you can check then that the cosine of the Weinberg angle then is forced by that requirement to be this. It's this ratio of the G2 gauge coupling to the length of the G1 plus G2 gauge coupling. It's this angle. Oh well, never mind. So let's just say it's given by this expression. And then you can also then once you do that linear transformation, you can read off that that this expression just becomes this expression, where now comparing the mass coefficient in front is here. This is now the mass of the Z boson. It's a quarter times the sum of the squares of the G1 of the SU2 and SU and U1 gauge couplings times the Higgs bev. So you can also see that if you take the ratio of these two guys, the ratio of the W boson mass to the Z boson mass, the ratio, the Higgs-Vev drops out, and it's just, if you measure the, so actually in 1983, people detected these gauge bosons as predicted, and they were able to measure their masses by where the peak and the momentum distributions were in the collider where they measured them. And so they were able to, in this way, measure this Weinberg angle, the ratio of the two gauge couplings, basically. Okay, one more thing to say here is that we found the Z boson mass by looking at the Z boson kinetic term and the Z boson mass term and writing them in the standard form, with a minus 1/4 in front of the kinetic term and a minus 1/2 in front of the mass term. And then finally, here we have just the kinetic term for the photon. You know, conventionally, the field strength corresponding to a mu is written f mu in electromagnetism, and so that's what I'm doing too. So this is the photon field kinetic term, and you see it has no corresponding mass term on the next line, so the photon is massless, just like the gluons were.
Can I ask a question?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Maybe we talked about it before as well, but like, can you go back? Why we don't make like out of that thing that we want to diagonalize? Why we don't interpret it as like two mass terms and one interaction term between W3 boson and B boson? why we don't want some interaction term between these vectors?
Oh yeah, good question. So I want a big eraser now. Well, okay. So yeah, the reason is that if we diagonalize it, then when we calculate the equation of motion for that, since we have diagonalized, for example, the Z boson term here. So since there's just a kinetic term for Z and a mass term for Z, now when I calculate the equations of motion, if I vary Z in this action and calculate what is the equation of motion for Z, it only involves Z. It doesn't talk to any of the other fields, and so the solution will just be that a solution for the Z field classically will just be a plane wave moving in some direction forever. And so that is what we normally, that is the, really, we could work in a more complicated basis where all the fields are mixed up, and even in the free theory, a wave that starts as a Z field, splits into if we'd worked in a previous basis, this same wave would be interpreted as a mixture of a W3 and an A3, and we would just talk about the wave that propagates with a well-defined mass I'm being incoherent about this. So if once we go to the Z basis, okay, the Z and A basis, then we find that the solution is a plane wave where K mu, the wave vector, the four moment, so it's a solution of the form e to the I K mu dot X mu, where the solution is when K mu squared is equal to minus some constant mass squared. Okay, that we'll find that's the solution of the equation of motion. And then for A mu, it'll be the same thing, but it'll only be a solution if K squared is equal to zero, and the form momentum squared is equal to zero. Now, if we had worked in the old basis, we would find that if we wanted to find a solution that was proportional to E to the I K mu dot X mu, where K satisfied some equation like k squared is equal to a constant, then it would only work if either we took this one linear combination of W3 and B, if we took a certain linear combination, then it would be a solution when k squared was equal to a positive constant, and for another linear combination we would take would be a solution when k squared was equal to zero. But if we took a general linear combination, it wouldn't have a solution which had that simple interpret. The solution would not have that simple expression where it was just proportional to e to the I k mu dot x mu, where k mu is equal to a constant. But in QFT, separating the solutions into a basis of solutions that each of which separately has that property, each of which is of the form e to the I k mu dot x mu, where k squared is equal to a constant that it gets interpreted as the mass of the particle. That is the sort of simplest and therefore the conventional basis in which to express, perturbation theory in quantum mechanics.
But still, even in the spaces of Z, like Z of A, we still are working with some linear combination of the fundamental fields that we had. Like, so it's still a linear combination, and we need to take into account that. The fundamental entities of the theory are W and B, not Z and A, right?
Exactly. So the things which propagate. Like a massive particle, or like a massless particle, the so-called mass eigenstates of the theory. those are these linear combinations of the fundamental fields that appear in the theory. So that's just the, it's just that there is this separation between what are the fields that make the logical structure of the theory most manifest. Those were the fields we started out with. Those are the ones that make it clear what the gauge symmetry is. But because of spontaneous symmetry breaking, there's this just complicating fact about nature that then the physical particles that physicists like to think about that actually have some well-defined mass or have some well-defined momentum, those are built from these different fields, which are linear combinations of the old fields. So those are the ones that you actually work with in perturbation theory, because those are the ones you know, when you draw a line in your Feynman diagram, you know, you want to say, oh, that's a particle with some mass and some momentum. But to do that, you have to work with these fields that diagonalize the part of the world.
Like, if you want to, like, picture in Feynman diagrams, like, if you wanted to work in the old basis, this way you would only have some vertices for, like, for the interactions between W and V bosons.
Yes, exactly. You would have, yeah, that's one way to say it. Yeah, you would be like you would have a, sometimes, you know, you would have a two-legged interaction vertex. You could have sometimes a leg in your diagram that started off as a B boson and just turned into a W3 boson. It would be like that. That's what the cross term would look like if you worked in terms of the
cross. Kind of things are like well defined in perturbation theory because.
No, they're well defined. You could work in this basis. It's just that, first of all, this line wouldn't. You could work it all out. It would just be that your life would be more complicated. You would have to include things like this, and the propagator would not have the simple form that you normally associate with a propagator for a thing that has a pure mass. It would be some more complicated thing because this is a combination of two things with two different masses. Yes?
The Weinberg angle, does it depend on the energy scale, or does it matter?
Let's wait until the RG, until we discuss the renormalization group, to discuss that. Yes, it does. All of the couplings in the standard model, as usually interpreted, run with energy scale, and so in particular the Weinberg angle does. So yeah, the thing that you this measured Weinberg angle is really the measured value of the Weinberg angle at the electroweak scale for the experiments that measure these particles.
And one more question is, like, I understand why we are rotating W3 and B,
mm-hmm.
but why are we rotating W1 and W2? They were already in that form.
Yeah, we didn't have to rotate anything to diagonalize. The only reason that we're defining this combined quantity W plus and W minus is that under a U1 transformation, W1 transforms into W2 and W2 transforms into W1, whereas under a U1 transformation, W plus transforms to W plus with an eigenvalue e to the i plus phi plus I phi, and W minus just transforms to W minus with eigenvalue e to the minus I phi. So they are the two irreps. Those are the two irreps under U1. You could alternatively think of a two-dimensional real irrep. You could alternatively think of W1 as a two-component real field. That's another way to think about it. But one way or another, W1 and W2 are not independent fields. They transform into one another. And so you need to work in a notation that makes it clear that they're not separate fields. That's all. It's not that we needed to diagonalize.
The rip of
U1
EM.
Sorry?
The rip of U1 electromagnetism.
Exactly. And the normal thing is true in all of electromagnetism, you know, with all the fermions, we're working with complex fields and they transform with a phase e to the I times their charge times phi. So writing W1 and W2 as W plus and W minus makes it have the same status, that it transforms with e to the I times its charge times. Yes, I think.
Is related to Sava's question. in QFT, we studied that the propagator has a pole in the physical mass of the field, but that mass is like the excitation, like the smallest excitation that you can construct, that is like the particle. Is that why we are doing this? So that we
can create a real... Exactly. That statement that you just made, that the propagator just has two poles, one at plus and minus the mass, where the frequency is plus or minus the mass, that is true if the propagator you're constructing is for a field that is diagonalized. Otherwise, the propagator would be a linear combination of two different functions, each of which had two different poles at two different poles.
Because we call propagator to the inverse of whatever thing is in the bilinear term of in a term that
exactly is exactly the propagators are always just the inverse of the operator, the coefficient of the quadratic terms in the. You had a question?
The table we had before now will change the numbers in it, so we have a new gauge boson that talk differently to different parts.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'll get to that. I'll get to that in after the next slide. I'm going to do the fermions first, and then that's yeah. Well, I'll show a table just. Okay. So, but before we get to that, let's talk about how to get the quadratic part of the fermion Lagrangian. Okay. So here is the here are the third and fourth lines of our Lagrangian, the two lines that have the fermion fields on them. And now we just want to do the same thing. We want to extract the quadratic part of this Lagrangian after we plug in the VEV after we split the Higgs field little h into VEV plus cap plus Higgs boson capital H. Okay, so let's look at these terms. So if we look first at these kinetic terms, well, you know, there's sort of two types of terms here. There's a term where in capital D, there's a partial derivative term, and okay. What I'm trying to say is that this term already involves two fields, so it's already quadratic automatically because it has two fermion fields in it. So I don't want to get any more fields from the covariant derivative. So if I think of the covariant derivative as partial plus a gauge field, I want to throw away the gauge field part because that'll give me a cubic term. But I only keep the partial derivative part. So everywhere in this Lagrangian, I'm going to replace capital D by little d by just its partial term. And then what about on the next line? Well, a similar sort of idea goes that in every one of these Yukawa terms, I already have two fields here, and I'm trying to find quadratic terms. So I don't want to get any more fields from the Higgs. So when I split the Higgs into a VEV part and a capital H part, the capital H part would make this term cubic. So I don't, that's an interaction term. I'm going to throw that away. I'm just going to keep the VEV part. Okay, so every time I see an H in the second line here, I'm just going to replace it by its VEV part. And H twiddle, if you work it out, you'll see that just, you know, in unitary gauge, going from, remember, H twiddle is just defined as I sigma 2 times H star. In unitary gauge, you'll see that just takes whatever is on the lower component of H and flips it to the top component. So H twiddle, the VEV part just looks like this. So whenever I see an H twiddle, I'll plug in V in the upper component. Finally, so far, you know, previously, before we broke symmetry, there was no reason to split Q left and L left into smaller bits because they were already irreducible representations of the symmetry. But now we've spontaneously broken the symmetry, so let's split them now into up left. I'm going to name now for the first time the upper and lower components up left and down left, and new left and e left, and plug that into the for q left and l left respectively, and now see why we're doing that and what the interpretation. Okay, so if we just do that, so the first line is just the same as before, but with partials instead of covariant derivatives. Oh, and because Q left has been replaced by U left and D left, this Q left kinetic term has split into two kinetic terms, a U left times U left bar U left, and a D left bar times D left. And similarly, the L left kinetic term has split into two kinetic terms, one for new left and one for e left. Okay, but otherwise the other guys have just come down. And then on the in terms of the Yukawa terms, well, so if I replace the if I first look at this first Yukawa term, I have U right comes this U right. But then for H twiddle, I've plugged in this expression over here with a, which only has a V in the upper component. So when H twiddle, it's SU2, it's a two component SU2 vector, which gets contracted with this two component SU2 vector. And since H twiddle only has an upper V component, you know, that upper V hits the U left in Q left and the zero hits the D left. So to make a long story short, instead of Q left in this term, we now have U left multiplying U right, and the same Yukawa matrix as before, and then the VEV from the Higgs I've just pulled out front because it comes out of all these terms. So similarly here, so in the first term, we had H twiddle, which has V in its upper component, so it selects U left here. But in the second term, we have H, which has V in its lower component, so when it gets contracted with Q left bar, it selects D left. So that's why we get D left times D right in this second term. And then here, in the E, we have E right times H, which only has a lower component, so it selects E left from the left-handed lepton double. So that's why we get this third term. So we get these three terms plus their Hermitian conjugates. And now the good thing to check to make sure you understand what I'm talking about here is that now we just want to clean up this expression because we notice that if we take our two we started with these two-component Weyl fermions, U left and U right, but now let's group them together, stick them all in the same four-component Dirac fermion U. U left is the top two components, U right is the bottom two components. If we do that, what we find is that this term and this term, the U left kinetic term and the U right kinetic term, just group together into this kinetic term. Just one for a kinetic term for the Dirac fermion U, the up quark U. And this term and its Hermitian conjugate, so remember this, the Hermitian conjugate of U left bar times YU times U right looks like U right bar times YU times U left. Because YU is just a real diagonal matrix. Normally you would get a YU dagger, but we've already diagonalized and made it real. So that term plus the Hermitian conjugate term gives this Dirac-like mass term for the up quark. And so what we see, where this mass matrix here, remember, where here we had this 3x3 dimensionless diagonal matrix times 1 over root 2v, I've just grouped all that stuff together and called that the mass matrix. So the mass matrix for the up quark is 1 over root 2 times the Yukawa matrix for the up quark. Okay, and we can just do an exactly analogous thing where we now define this Dirac four-component spinner for the down quark, which again combines the right-handed part of the down quark, the right-handed down quark field, this guy, with the left-handed down quark field, this guy. Well, not quite, because notice that the left-handed down quark field, we would run into a hitch if we tried to just put D left here, because there's this VCKM matrix, this 3x3 part of the Yukawa matrices that, remember last time, we were not able to define away. We couldn't completely diagonalize the Yukawa matrices. There weren't enough fields to do it. So we were left with this unitary matrix VCKM. So to get the mass eigenstates here, we have to define this new, we have to make a rotation here, where we define D left prime, which is related to our original field D left, by this CKM transformation, and it's this D left prime which appears in the mass eigenstates. Okay, so D is a combination of D right and D left prime. But then once you do that, again, for now the Lagrangian looks like just the Lagrangian for the Ds just looks like the Lagrangian for a simple massive Dirac fermion D as an ordinary Dirac kinetic term and an ordinary Dirac mass term. And similarly for the E's, we do the same thing. We define this E, which is a combination of E left and E right. And then we find the kinetic term and the mass term both simplify nicely. And so at the end of the day, we see that by this rewriting, the quadratic part of the Lagrangian, what we've ended up with is, you know, we started off with these six different Weyl fermion fields, but now we have a massive Dirac fermion, the up quark, a massive Dirac fermion, the down quark, and a massive Dirac fermion, the electron. And then the only guy that didn't become massive was the neutrino. It didn't have, there was no fourth, because there's no right-handed neutrino, and because there's no right-handed neutrino in the minimal standard model, there was no one for it to form a Dirac fermion with. And so it just is left alone with this Weyl kinetic term and no mass term. So in the minimal standard model, the neutrino is a left-handed Weyl fermion that's massless. So that's what I'm saying. And the masses of all the fermions that do get masses, you might have heard people say, you know, the matter fields in nature get their mass from the Higgs boson. This is what they're talking about. That you see that all of the masses of the fermions that do get masses here are proportional to the VeV of the Higgs field. So it's they're given by the Yukawa matrices. The masses are just given by the Yukawa couplings to the Higgs, dimensionless Yukawa couplings times this VeV, which is a mass which has dimensions of mass. It's some number 246 GeV, and that's what the masses of all the particles in nature. That's where they actually come from. So to summarize this part of the Lagrangian, we have now extracted the physical content of the standard model. What are the basic particles and their masses? So the physical content, the free part of the Lagrangian after spontaneous symmetry breaking, we have one, in terms of scalar fields, we just have one scalar field. We took our Higgs field, we put it in unitary gauge, we split it into a VeV, which we determined to have a particular value in terms of the parameters in the standard model. And then there was this one boson, physical field in nature, which had this mass. In terms of vector fields, fields that do have a Lorentz index, bosonic fields that have one Lorentz index like this, we found that there were 9 massless ones, the 8 gluon fields corresponding to SU3, the 1 photon field corresponding to the 1 unbroken symmetry from the original SU2 times U1 electroweak symmetry. And then from the broken symmetries, the 3 broken symmetries gave rise to 3 massive bosons, the W plus and W minus bosons had this mass, and the Z boson, which is neutral, electrically neutral and has this mass. And then for the fermions, we found that most of them became massive and turned into Dirac 4-component fermions. A Dirac fermion has 4 physical degrees of freedom. It can be spin up or spin down, and it can be a particle or an antiparticle. So each of these guys is like that, up quark, down quark, and electron, with these masses, given by basically their Yukawa coupling times the Higgs VeV. And then there's one massless Weyl spinner, the neutrino, which is just left-handed, meaning that it's a particle with only 2 degrees of freedom. This field can either describe a massless fermion that is has helicity minus, meaning that its spin is a particle with its spin oriented opposite to its momentum, or an antiparticle with its spin oriented along its momentum. And then there's 3 generations worth of those guys. So those are the particles in the standard model. So now let's go on to try to, in a blitz, we can do it. No, we can't do it. Well, we can try. It'll be fun to try. let's see how they interact, and then we'll have completed the Feynman rules. Okay, good. So I'll switch to lecture 8 here. Okay, so here is the table you were mentioning a moment ago. So instead of our old table now, which was described to the standard model fields before spontaneous symmetry breaking, sort of real logically correct ones, because really there were all those symmetries in the standard model. They haven't actually been broken. It's just that the vacuum doesn't respect them, so it looks like they're broken. You have to be Sheldon-Glashow or something to appreciate that to figure out that these symmetries are actually in nature. They're not like staring you in the face at low energy. So what is left at low energies? Well, our SU3 column here is unchanged because SU3 was not broken. So everybody has the same SU3 charges they had before. I should say I've added rows here because I've split Q left into U left and D left now, and I've split L left into nu left and E left. But otherwise, these are the same rows as in the previous table, and the same SU3 charges. But now SU2 and U1 got broken. Now I'm just putting in a column here for the third SU2 generator and what each field's eigenvalue is with respect to that generator. So up left, because it lives in the upper component of, remember this generator is 1/2 times the third poly sigma matrix, 1/2 times the matrix 1 - 1. So if you ask, that's for the fermions that transformed as doublets, and then for the left-handed fermions, that's what it is, and then for the right-handed fermions, the T3 generator would be 0 because they don't transform. So we just ask, what are each of these guys' eigenvalues under T3? Now, since U3 is in the upper component, it has eigenvalue +1/2. Since D left is in the lower component of Q left, it has eigenvalue -1/2. U right and D right are both 0 because they don't transform, and the new left similarly and E left are +/-1/2, and U right and E right are 0 and 0, and the Higgs field, because it lives in the lower component of the Higgs doublet, has E3 equals -1/2. So that these are sometimes called the weak isospin values for fields E3. And then we saw that the actual unbroken charge, U1 charge at the end of the day was T3. Here I've just repeated all of their hypercharges from the previous table. Those haven't changed. And then the actual electric charge Q is the sum of their weak hypercharge. And remember, this was the generator that was unbroken, that annihilated the Higgs web, was T3 plus Y. So that's the electric charge. You can just add up this column and this column to get 2/3 minus 1/3, et cetera. And you see that everybody has now their well-known electric charges. Both of the up quarks now have charge 2/3. Both of the down quarks now have electric charge -1/3. Both of the neutrino fields have electric charge 0. And both of the electron fields now have electric charge -1. And the Higgs field has electric charge 0, which is why it has been so hard to detect directly, which is why it took so long to detect it. Okay, good. So the interaction terms, so we spent a lot of time trying to extract all of the terms in this Lagrangian that were quadratic in the fields after spontaneous symmetry breaking. Now we want to do exactly the opposite. We want to ignore the quadratic ones and just look at all the rest of the terms and ask what Feynman diagrams come from each of those. Okay, so I was just going to go line by line and look at the Feynman diagrams that come from each line here. So one slide for each, because each one has a bunch of interesting content. I should say, it's kind of a gritty two lectures working out all of these terms in detail and all of the, but it's also like 10 Nobel Prizes worth of stuff. So it's like every little detail is a Nobel Prize. It's important to say these are not just sort of any old details to work out. These are really worth going through and working out on your own, because this sort of thing is, there's a lot of content in all these details. Okay, so I was going to work out the Feynman diagrams on the first line in most detail, and just the first term here. I was going to work out the Feynman diagrams in most detail just to show you how you would do it in detail if you wanted to get the exact rules for each vertex. In view of time, I think maybe I will skip a little bit more lightly over this. I'll just say, So okay, so what goes on here? So g, we have g squared. Each g has a linear term and a quadratic term. And so when we square it, well, the linear term times the linear term will give us a quadratic term. We've already dealt with that. We're going to throw that away. So we have two types of terms that appear. We either get a cubic term coming from multiplying a linear term times a quadratic term, or we get a quartic term coming from multiplying two quadratic terms. So let's first think about the quartic term that comes from multiplying two quadratic terms. So the term in the Lagrangian we get by looking at here I've just expanded out in terms of this gigantic expression, and I've just moved all of the Lorentz indices here and here down, so I have to have these corresponding metric tensors in front to contract up their indices. Now I'm just throwing away everything except the quadratic, the quartic term that I get by multiplying these two powers of g times these two powers of g. So I get, you know, I get this expression, and the bottom line is that to now write this quartic term gives rise to a Feynman rule. What are the rules of the game? You know, every term higher than quadratic, I get to write down a vertex for it where I basically strip off all the fields in that term, and I write down in the corresponding vertex here, I have one leg for each of those corresponding fields. I label those four legs by those four fields. And then the factor that I include in the Feynman diagram is just I times whatever coefficient appeared in front of that. So I've just have this coefficient here, and I've just multiplied it by I, and that is the coefficient that goes with this vertex in the Feynman diagram. The only thing here is that I've mentioned that, you know, really if you think about for any fixed values of mu and m and nu and et cetera, all the indices, you know, there's actually 24 different ways they appear in this combination because we're summing over all of those dummy indices. If you think it through carefully, you actually need all 24 permutations of this term. So that's the by far the most complicated. These are, you know, these gauge boson interaction vertices look the most complicated of all the Feynman rules in the standard model. But I'm just trying to explain how, in principle, if you wanted to work out exactly what it was, because you wanted to do some very precise calculation, this is what you would do. So similarly, you also get the three gauge gluon vertices that I mentioned before, which come from multiplying a linear term here times a quadratic term here and getting a term in the Lagrangian involving three g's. And similarly, you get some sort of corresponding three gauge boson vertex from that. Now, what about these other two terms? Well, this guy doesn't contribute any. This guy is just a linear. Remember, this is a U1 gauge field, so it doesn't have any commutator terms in its definition of B mu. So this term is already quadratic. So we really just care about this term. And this term again, you know, each W has a linear part and a quadratic part. And so when we take quadratic times quadratic, we get this quartic term with a Feynman diagram like this, or quadratic times linear, we get this cubic term with a Feynman diagram like this. But again, this is so life is pretty simple, and you know, this term, as it involves, this term goes as the gauge coupling, the SU2 gauge coupling squared, because it involves squaring this term where G2 appeared, whereas this term goes linearly in the SU2 gauge coupling because it involved multiplying a term, this term, which did involve G2, times this term, which didn't. But now we want to re-express that in terms of the actual physical fields, the W plus minus bosons and the Z and A bosons. And so you can go through and check it yourself, but the bottom line is that the non-zero fields, the non-zero vertices you get, well, they all have to conserve electric charge. So the total charge of all the particles coming into that vertex has to add up to zero in order to conserve electric charge. And so, for example, when we just rewrite all of these fields in terms of the physical field basis, well, we get a 4W vertex, but it has to involve two W pluses and two W minuses coming in to conserve charge. Or we could also conserve charge by having just two W's come in, but it has to be in the combination W plus and W minus. And then the other two can be either Z's or A's. And then from this three boson vertex, we find that when we rewrite in terms of the physical fields, again, to conserve charge, it has to, two of the legs have to be W plus and W minus, and the remaining one can be either of the two neutral bosons, Z or A. Okay, so those are the, so now those are all the Feynman diagrams coming from the first line. What about the second line? Okay, the second line is where all the Higgs fields are, the Higgs kinetic term and the Higgs potential term. First, talk about the Higgs potential term. So remember, we had plugged in this expression, little h is equal to V plus capital H, and we had already talked about the terms zeroth order in capital H. Those were swept into the cosmological constant, the vacuum energy. There's a constant term. The linear term we had to cancel because we were sitting at the vacuum at the VEV. The quadratic term already went into the mass term for the Higgs field. So what we're left with are the terms that are cubic and quartic in H. And so if you think there's a term like this, which if you think about it will involve one power of the coupling constant lambda here and one power of the VEV times H cubed. So that'll have a diagram with three H's, three H legs, and a coefficient which is proportional to lambda times the Higgs VEV. And then there's the quartic term, which involves four powers of H. And it's just multiplied by the coupling, the quartic coupling lambda, the dimensionless coupling lambda. And so that'll be a four-legged Higgs vertex like this. What about from the kinetic term? What do we get from there? Well, if you work it out, you'll see that, all the interaction terms, all the terms higher than quadratic have to involve an H here. And so the question is just whether when we, if you just expand out this term and connect and collect all of the quadratic, higher than quadratic terms, you'll see there's a cubic term involving one H and two vector fields, which could either be two Z's or a W plus and a W minus to conserve charge, because H has zero charge. Or you could get two H's, one coming from each of these two terms, and two gauge fields, which could either be two Z's or a W plus and a W minus. Third line. This one, let's see. You know, as much as my dream was to finish it all, these two are important enough that but I'm just going to bowl ahead and do them. No, I'm going to stop. Maybe what if I do them slightly out of order, because the fourth line is easier than the third line. So how about that? Time to do the fourth line. So the fourth line is where all the Yukawa terms are. So you know we substitute it in. You know H is equal to zero V plus H. And to get the quadratic terms, we kept the V part of this expression. But now, to get the interaction terms, we're just going to do the opposite. We're just going to keep the capital H part of this expression. So all the terms will look exactly like they did before when we substituted the VEV, except wherever we used to have a little V, we're now going to have a capital H. And so in the story is the same as in our last slide of the quadratic Lagrangian. We get these three terms, but instead of mass terms, they involve three fields, two Dirac fermions now interacting with the Higgs field. And so that has a Feynman diagram where there's the Higgs field and our Dirac fermion, two Dirac fermions coming in and out. And now the interaction, the vertex factor is just I times Y, the Yukawa coupling of that fermion, times 1 over root 2. So, you know, a notable fact here is that, but remember that at the end of the previous lecture, we learned that the mass of that corresponding fermion was just equal to the VEV of the Higgs times its Yukawa coupling. So, in other words, we can rewrite this interaction vertex, the vertex vector, as minus I times the mass of the fermion over B. So that's a fundamental prediction of the standard model that, you know, every different type of fermion has a different interaction strength with the Higgs boson, and the ones that interact the strongest with the Higgs boson, the ones that have the biggest vertex vectors are the most massive ones. Their interaction strength is proportional to their mass. So this is a prediction that the top quark should scatter more strongly off of the top quark, which is the heaviest fermion, should scatter the strongest off the Higgs boson, and the B quark should be next, and with precise ratios. That's an example of a very testable prediction, which has been being tested since the discovery of the Higgs. Well, it was more indirectly tested already before, but now it's getting much more directly tested since we can actually make Higgs. Yeah.
For the Feynman items of the fermions, we are using their expression post-symmetry rating, but for the Feynman rules of the bosons, we were writing the rules for the B mu mu and the B mu mu bosons, which are higher symmetry.
So what I meant to say, I was trying to write them all, I was trying to get, at the end get to, so here, are you talking about this slide maybe? Yeah, so here I was trying to sort of, really the Feynman diagrams we want at the end of the day are the ones at the on the last line here, which are written in terms of the physical bosons. I was just writing this initial line as kind of preparation for. So you don't actually use these diagrams in perturbation theory calculations. It's just that I was trying to express that if you had written it in terms of that old basis of the W123s, you would have these three and four legged vertices. And I was trying to motivate without doing the calculation explicitly that's why you get three and four legged vertices in terms of the physical bosons, because ultimately all of these physical diagrams which you do use come from rewriting, splitting each of the legs on these three and four legged sort of more academic vertices into a linear combination of the physical bosons, and then each of those splits, if you want, into a bunch of different possible three and four legged vertices, which I've summarized. So yeah, sorry to be confusing about that. So you don't use these vertices. These are the ones.
One thing which I'm always confused about is, suppose we do experiments at an energy scale which is so high that the symmetry is not broken, then can we find scattering amplitudes of those unbroken?
Yeah, if you were working at very high temperatures so that the symmetry was not broken, or if the Higgs potential had, you know, Higgs potential happens to have this, the measured fact, the observed fact is that the Higgs potential looks like this, because the m squared appearing in the Lagrangian has a certain sign. If that m squared had a different sign and the potential looked like this and the VEV was at the center, then first of all, even in the vacuum, you would have unbroken symmetry, and you would do the Feynman diagrams that you would have just read off from the original Lagrangian with no spontaneous symmetry breaking. But then, like you say, at high temperatures, yes, it turns out that the thermally corrected effective potential, there's a thermal term that comes at sufficiently high temperatures above the electroweak phase transition, makes the effective potential look like the minimum is at the symmetry restored phase. And so then, yes, you would just then work with the Feynman diagrams would use the unbroken, would use the basic particles that we started with, or would be better formulated in terms of the fields we started with. And you would have to also include the thermal corrections to all of the different vertices and propagators. That's the one of all of the same thermal corrections that correct the Higgs field end up causing modifications to the Feynman rule. But yeah, it would be more convenient and natural to work in terms of more symmetric variables above the electric.
I have one question about the mean scene between W3 and V, because I understand that we are diagonalizing our matrix, but I don't understand why the change of basis is going to be a rotation. How do we know that angle is really an angle?
Yeah. Let's see. Where?
Without experience.
Oh, sorry. I guess that was. So the reason that that was a rotation matrix as opposed to a more general 2x2 matrix, is that what you're wondering about? That was because, so suppose I okay, so we're focusing now on this two field subspace consisting of the W3 term here and the B term here. So we have, so if you just focus on that one, you have minus a quarter times W3 squared and minus a quarter times B squared. Or in other words, you could write that as minus a quarter times the identity, the 2x2 identity matrix, with it on one side by the vector W3B, and on the other side by the vector W3B. Okay, like there's a column vector and a row vector, and if I just multiply them with an identity matrix in between them, then I get back the Lagrangian that I have. Now, I want to do a rotation. Imagine I do some rotation. So I want to do a rotation on this field and on this field that preserve the identity matrix. So I want my matrix to satisfy the property. Then you'll see if you plug it in that the rotation matrix times its transpose is equal to the identity matrix. That's the condition for it to be an orthogonal matrix. So it's the requirement that I not screw up the identity matrix form in that 2x2 sector, which forces me to do only an orthogonal.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Related to his question and the answer you gave, what does it mean that potential of some field is temperature dependent? I used to think potential is something fundamental related to that field that nature chooses.
Say it again. For example, in the early universe, the universe is full of all these particles are so. Today, the temperature is the temperature is out in outer space, let's say, or in a vacuum in the LHC where you're scattering particles, is essentially zero. Okay, so you're working basically at zero temperature. Temperature is not relevant. It's not like the whole process. You can just think of the two particles as basically moving and not hitting anything until they hit each other, okay, in your scattering process. So temperature is sort of not relevant in particle scattering experiments, you know, today in typical laboratory environments. But you know, think now instead about a situation where you're trying to ask, you know, what's the scattering between two different standard model particles. But in the early universe, where the universe was full of a thick plasma of particles at some temperature, so now you know, now those two particles don't just kind of get to travel unobstructed towards one another; they may be kind of getting rattled or hitting other particles on their way, and so this finite temperature field theory is a way to effectively describe the physics of that system by taking the fact that the whole thing is embedded in a plasma of in a plasma of all those particles in thermal equilibrium with one into account.
I get that, but my point is.
So that temperature is nothing intrinsic about the standard model. It's the external conditions of whatever set the temperature of the plasma, which can change. So in particular, as the universe expands, for example, it cools down, temperature drops.
I get that. I mean, the behavior of the field can be the function of temperature. I mean, where the field lives in the potential.
Mm-hmm.
But the form of the potential shouldn't really be a function of temperature.
Well, it's the effective potential. So it's saying that the So this is the potential that for example, you know, if you wanted to determine the, there's a sense in which it's true that the there is this potential, the unthermally corrected part, which is always whatever it is, the effective potential, but for practical purposes, you may be asking a question for which that potential is not the relevant quantity. So for example, you know, often, you know, what you use a potential for is to determine, where should I expect the VEV of the field to be? Where is the expectation value of the field? You usually want it to be sitting at the minimum of the potential. But when you heat it up enough, that ceases to be true, because although there is this kind of zero temperature force which wants to fix it to a position away from the origin, you know, in thermal equilibrium, it's getting knocked around from place to place, and the effects of the Higgs field being battered by a surrounding plasma, that turns out to tend to want to pin it to zero as it, and so the overall potential, which correctly predicts what the expectation value of the field will be as a function of temperature, turns out to be the sort of original zero temperature potential plus some correction terms, which go like 1/2 times temperature squared times the Higgs field squared. That's the leading correction. So you know, when you add that potential to the zero temperature thing, that effective thermal potential is the thing whose minimum correctly predicts where the VEV will be as a function of temperature.
Okay. I used to think that the theories are symmetric at high temperatures, and when temperature drops, a kind of symmetry breaking happens.
Yes.
The form of potential, which is symmetric, is more fundamental, but you're saying the reverse, that we have this potential which is unsymmetric, but temperature fluctuations effectively provides a potential which is symmetric.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, definitely the high temperature symmetry restored potential, you would say, is less fundamental, in the sense that it's not the thing, for example, that directly appears in the path integral, you know. Yeah, the most exact thing is the actual honest to God potential, but it's just very convenient, effective thing. Just like anything about statistical mechanics, you know, the free energy and all of these things describe just the statistical.
Thank you. Just had a suggestion for this slide.
Yes.
Most of the apps have a highlighting option that disappear automatically after some time.
Oh yeah, that's a good idea. You're right. Maybe I should do that. That's a good idea. I think I have that too, don't I? Right. Smart. Okay. 11, that's a good idea. Thank you for the suggestion.